is coming.
Hello and welcome to Vassals of Kingsgrave. Today we are going to be continuing the Great Linear A Song of Ice and Fire reread. This episode could potentially spoil any events from George R. R. Martin's published series. However, we will be talking about the Winds of Winter spoiler chapters later in the show, but I'll give a warning when we end up talking about those. There will also be no show spoilers in this episode. Today we'll be covering the epilogue in Arya 13 from A Storm of Swords and Arryn 2 from A Feast for Crows. And today I am joined by Matt.
Hi, how you doing? It's Blue Armor on the forums.
Noah.
Hey guys, Pops88 on the forums, no in real life.
Nadia.
Hi guys, this is Nadia.
Tanya.
Hi, I'm Silence on the forums.
And hopefully we'll be joined by Gaiden on the forums at some point. And I, of course, am Blue-Eyed Queen on the forums, Casey in real life. In the last episode, we finished with Victarion 1 on January 29, 300 from Feast for Crows. We're going to jump back 19 chapters to the epilogue of A Storm of Swords. And this takes place a day later. And Matt, you have the chapter summary for this one.
All right, here we go. Merit Frey, the ninth son of Lord Walder, is riding through the woods, and life sucks. It's cold outside, it's snowing in fucking autumn, the trail up the hill is steep, he's still sober, he's got a permanent brain damage like he's an NFL running back, and there are outlaws everywhere. Merit hates outlaws. They ruined his life. He was a big man, destined to be a great knight. He was squired to Lord Crakehall and fought the Kingswood Brotherhood alongside Jaime Lannister. Or at least he would have. Instead, he was given chlamydia before the battle, captured by the White Wan, and then knocked into a two-week coma. At the Red Wedding, Merit had one job, outdrink the Great John. However, there's one problem. No one outdrinks the Great John. It took 8 men to bring him down. He wounded 2, killed 1, and took Leslyn Hay's ear Mike Tyson style. Merit's the ninth son of a lord. He has no land or money to his name. His wife hates him. His first daughter's a slut. His second daughter is fat and just married Roose Bolton. And he's got this itchy tramp stamp on his ass that the White Fawn gifted him. Merit has never had much luck with the women. But you know who has? The true hero of this story. Black Walder Frey. He is the fourth. No, wait, the third. No, hold on. Now he's the second in line to inherit the twins. He slept with his cousin, Merit's previously alluded to slut daughter, both of his brother's wives, and Lord Walder's seventh wife. Look out, Edwin. Black Walder coming. Anyway, back to Merit. For some reason, he's walking into the spooky ruined castle by himself to hand over a ransom demand to a bunch of outlaws. A Frey of all people should know not to go towards the creepy music. High in the halls of the kings who are gone, Jenny would dance with her ghosts. On this day, Jenny danced with the woman Merit saw die. She was dead for 24 hours before they threw her naked corpse in the river. She couldn't speak because her throat had been cut from ear to ear, but she could nod. The last of Merit's courage ran down his leg, and his body was lifted up and up and up and up. Chapter.
That was fantastic. I like thinking of Merit now as having CTE from head injuries.
Wow.
Yes. So where do we want to start here? There's so much Frey things we learn here, and there's also Lady Stoneheart, who is probably like a very notorious character in A Storm of Swords, even though she's only in the last paragraph, basically.
That's like a very basic question. Would it not have been, that's so many Freys, would it not have been a good idea to double up and send the second person? I don't know if that would have helped, but it just seems unnecessarily stupid.
I mean, not necessarily a second Frey, but at least, like, I don't know, an honor guard. Yeah,
like anyone, but like the point is that there's like more than enough Freys that they probably would have had another one they could have sent along, or like anyone, but like it just would have seemed like a good idea not to go alone. I don't know that it would have helped him, but
I feel like
it just
with
unnecessarily.
No, I feel like it kind of like shows like how they don't want to waste any of their people. Like they're very protective. Like even like. They keep their people in during the war, and then they kind of come in like half-assed towards the end. Like they're very like they don't want to give up their people for some reason.
But then they're treating this one as very disposable, right? Because it just doesn't seems like the unsafest thing to do.
They're both very disposable. Both Merit and Peter Pimple are, you know, nobody cares about them. So it's not like it's going to be a great loss for the Freys if they die.
Yeah, Peter Pimple is quite a name. So I'm going to read a comment that Bina had posted here. God is dead. Everything is permitted. The Red Wedding is such a violent rupture to Westerosi common law that we are truly in the wilderness now. It's amazing how George chooses to end a book that has so much content and so many themes on this one, the most important one, up until the Red Wedding law was breaking down, but now it's truly gone. You see that reflected in the rise of outlaw vengeance that... You see that reflected in the rise of outlaw vengeance, but also Tyrion's kangaroo court trial, and even the way Jon is locked up by Thorne's Slit.
Yeah, even the Brotherhood had a code. They lived by a code, right? When it was Beric leading them, they were still doing, like, they were still doing everything in Robert's name. They were taking from the rich. They weren't pretending to be Robin Hoods, but, you know, they were, like, trying to protect the common people, right? That was their basic aim. But now, after Beric has kind of passed it on to Captain Stark, she's basically just out for revenge. That's all she wants.
And so they also had some sort of legal system. Like, you can argue how fair or valid that was. But when they ran into the Hound, they gave him a trial, right?
Yeah, it seems like everything is kind of like nobody cares who is in charge. They're kind of making their own rules now, since it seems like the Freys have like broke the what at least like. Most people consider a very important rule, depending on who, what houses you're looking at. Catelyn Stark, now Lady Stoneheart, although, was she even named as Lady Stoneheart in this chapter? I don't think she was.
I don't think so. No.
She's not named at all.
So. Why do we call her Lady Stoneheart then?
That's a good, I assume, feast.
I guess she's just known as that, isn't she?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm like trying to remember because like I listen, Feast for Crows and Clash of Kings are like the two books that I listen to primarily on audiobook. So like my memory of them is not as good as like the other books.
She's named as Lady Catelyn in one of the last sentences, so she's definitely named. So we know who it is, I guess.
Yeah.
I always feel most sorry for poor Merritt because his stepson is Roose Bolton.
Okay, yeah, she gets the title of Stoneheart and Feast. As like a rumor in the same way they called like Beric the Lightning Lord.
Oh, okay.
It's just kind of like the rumor going around the Riverlands.
Yeah.
The small folk.
Yeah.
So what is Merit in line to the twins? Is he way down the pecking
order? Oh yeah, he's way down. He's the ninth son.
Right. He's the ninth son. So isn't there's a little theory about Blackwalder killing off his competition, really, isn't it?
Right. Yeah, no, I think that's pretty much a definite.
He's like the third in line, so he doesn't have to kill like that many people.
Right. No, that's
right. Mandalay kills one of them, doesn't he?
No.
He kills other ones, but they're farther down.
Yeah.
He started the series as the fourth, and they became, and then what is it? Stevron died.
To make
him the third, and then Rhyman gets killed at the end of Feast to make him the second.
Just his brother left, right?
Yeah, it's just Edwin, and like Edwin knows that he's coming for him, but
yeah.
It's amazing to me that you guys like know all this lineage stuff because like I had to look it up a little bit last night when I was reading, and like these are like the things that I don't really care about when it comes to. Like, Frey lineage is something that I don't really pay attention to when I read these books.
I mean, no, it's something I had to research, but...
Anyone feel a little sorry for him?
I did. I felt like he was handed a rough... Like, as he said, he's very unlucky, and, like, yeah, he's pretty unlucky as far as, like, you know, being, like... you know, made to be a knight, potentially, and then having that all taken away from him by presumed CTE. that would suck. Like, to be, like, supposed to be this great person, or, like, you know, at least in his mind, like, what the best he could have been, and then have that all taken away from him. And I guess, like, my only, like, you know... thought of him this being like not feeling sorry for him is like that him his disdain about being beaten up by a woman I thought was so funny when I was reading this. I was like, all right, cool, we've seen strong women in here, get over it.
He wasn't just beaten by her, he was humiliated, like he was branded.
Yeah got that nice branding that. on his ass.
Yeah.
I think it's quite telling when a little bit down the line you get Jamie's thoughts on how he remembers him. And he was always a bit of a bully and all that, and then he just kind of, and now he's this
very sad character that you, yeah, you feel, you empathize with at the end.
Yeah, I feel bad for how he has to go, because it seems like he doesn't really have, he didn't have like a big part in the Red Wedding. He was just, it seemed like he was complicit to just what happened. Because I know that we've talked about in past episodes, like whether the Freys knew about what was going to happen or whether they didn't. It seems like he definitely knew what was going down, but there was also like a moment of like just pure confusion going on at the Red Wedding.
Did he seem like a little bit bitter about not having been given a more important job? It seemed like he was a bit bitter about not having been given anything more important to do. So I feel like him only having a small part wasn't really by his choice, so I don't think that makes him any easier to empathize with.
Yeah, it's a weird one, actually, that there are so many Freys, but not a single one did anything to stop it, you know, just with a moral sense of this is wrong.
I mean, I guess there's a strong sense of family loyalty, and I mean, what would you do, like, if you stopped it, where would you go after?
Oliver Frey was sent away because he had been robbed by her.
Of course.
He was like Rosalind. He was Rosalind's full brother, but he wasn't at the wedding because presumably he had disappeared, or they didn't tell him because he was Lawyer Rob.
You're right. And the knight who went with Catelyn to treat with Renly.
Yeah, was it Perwin Frey?
Perwin, yeah, that rings a bell.
Perwin, if I remember correctly, Perwin is also a full brother to Rosalind. These are like people who should have been at the wedding, but they weren't. And that's like the first. That's when Catelyn first realizes that something's wrong. When she asks about Oliver, and they tell her he's not here, he's gone away. And then she asks about Perwin, and he's away. And then she starts thinking, okay, there's something wrong.
Yeah. One thing that I picked up at the beginning of this chapter was just Merritt's description of how destroyed everything was in the Riverlands, as far as their farming and their shelters and just like things that you would need for like basic survival for a impending winter coming up. I kind of wonder, like, with all this destruction, like how much of a chance do these people actually have, like as far as like common folk go, like how much of a chance do these people have of actually like surviving a winter despite like the impending doom of the wall and dragons?
I would say they wouldn't if it was going to be a normal winter that like lasted a long period of time. They're actually going to get saved by the fact that presumably at the end of the story, winter is just going to come to an abrupt end. So I think they'll have enough to make it through to that point.
But it does seem odd to me that Merritt was even kind of worried about, like, his own survival, like, not being able to, like, get food at some point. And he's, like, he's not necessarily, like, a very important person, but he is part of, like, a noble-ish house.
Yeah.
He has no source of income, just because that's the main problem with the Freys, where there's just way too many of them. And so only, like, the very top ones, like, are actually, make any money. And everyone else just kind of relies on the trickle-down part of it, so... I mean, the only difference between him and the common folk is that he has, a roof over his head that he can stay at.
Yeah.
Snowing in autumn is going to be a hard one. The small folk would know that.
Yeah.
Probably keen to get to castles somewhere, like Wintertown and Winterfell. I wonder if they have a similar thing in the south, but there's never been that bad a winter, I'd imagine.
Well, with the war and everything, it seems like, and especially with like Merritt's constant fear of outlaws, it seems like it might be dangerous for people to go traveling to like safety or whatever. Even to like the King's Landing, or I guess in that area, the closest place would be like maybe even the Freys. I'm trying to think of like what houses are like okay in the Riverlands for like normal people to go to.
Maybe it's more of a comment like the Freys can't focus on winter because of this mess that they've created. They've kind of just been fueling fire to the chaos and not being like, oh shit, and looking at the signs that nature given you that it's going to be a hard winter.
I mean, there are comments, I think, in Feast that mention like there's a lot of refugees that are traveling down to King's Landing that like Cersei has to like turn away or deal with. I don't know.
Yeah, well, maybe that's it, as in the north, they have the winter towns, like I said, and then in the south, you turn to the faith, and, they'll become, like, poor fellows and sparrows and stuff.
And that's how movements start, religious movements. I'm looking at my notes. Did anybody else feel like incredibly bad for Jingle Bell all over again?
I don't feel bad for any of the Freys, man. That's just one of my favorite like mini games going forward. Is just seeing like how many get taken out. I have a running like total up farther on in my notes.
That's probably a good wager. Who do you reckon is going to be the last Frey standing?
Ooh, yeah.
Just like I legitimately think that Black Walder is going to take over at some point during the series. I mean,
there's too many of them for all of them to be killed.
Right? Yeah, he won't survive it in the end, but I think he's going to like take over the twins for at least a good chunk of the like maybe final book.
And then Olivar is going to come back riding Grey Wind and murder Black Walder.
I would love to see that.
So here's a question about bringing back dead people. How, like, in what kind of shape do you have to be at least to be brought back? Presumably, like, if you don't have your head anymore, you probably can't be brought back. Like, how is there any way to kill someone and be certain that they're not going to come back?
Burning them.
Yeah, I think didn't Arya ask Beric about this? Beric and Toros, that if a man has lost his head, can you bring him back? And I think what this is,
we know someone whose head has been.
Yeah, she was asking because her father had lost her head, lost his head.
Yeah,
but yeah, I think in Catelyn's case, it was just like a general. Decaying of the body, but she hadn't like lost her head.
Yeah, I guess she's not too badly. I don't know.
Right. It has to be done fairly quickly, but it's still just kind of random chance.
But in Catelyn's case, a few days had already passed, right?
24 hours.
No, 24 hours later, they threw her body.
Oh, that's right, before they threw him. Yeah. She'd been in there.
Yeah, and then the wolves found it a bit later.
Yeah.
The timelines, like, as far as, like, the linear timeline goes that we have, that we're using for this reread, I think, like, the timeline of her being, like, captured, at least, like, Arya has a dream about a month after the Red Wedding, but we also hear something about, I think, like, I don't know, like, something that's less than that, so I don't know if she was having, like, a retrospective dream. But Catelyn is pretty, like, even in the description, it sounds like she's very, like, well into decay when they revived her.
But the description is horrifying, like,
oh yeah,
her flesh has turned pudding soft. That's creepy.
Her eyes sound very haunting, and just everything just seems very un-Catelyn-like, except for the pure vengeance of that's left of her personality, basically. So what do we think is Stoneheart's future in, like, do we see her directly at any portion? We just hear word of her, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, so it's with Brienne at the end, that's the next time we see her. It's the only two appearances, if I'm...
Yeah.
Correct.
She's not even named in this chapter, but it's pretty, he makes it obvious it's Catelyn.
In this one? Yeah. In this one she is, though. It says...
Is he?
Yeah, like, at the end.
Shocking lack of knowledge.
Yeah, so first she's described and she's not named, but then at some point it says Lady Catelyn's eyes never left him. She nodded. That's like the third sentence, third to last sentence.
I didn't get that far.
Just missed off the last few sentences.
Shocking lack of knowledge.
I will say that the final sentence is like the best part.
I wonder, though, like, you know, we were supposed to, after Storm of Swords, get a, gap between the books, and we ended up getting Feast and Winds instead. So I wonder, like, with his plans for, like, this is the last chapter of this book, like, I wonder, like what he has planned for her in Winds, because I feel like that's a pretty important thing to, like, end on and to not, like, go back to in the next two books seems very odd.
Yeah, I mean, I would expect her just to keep doing what they're doing. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no way she survives the whole series. And it's really hard to gauge, just because, you know, the confrontation between her and Brienne and Jaime is going to be a big one. And it's hard to predict the outcome of that, confrontation. I don't know, but yeah, but other than that, like, you know, she'll keep hunting Freys. I'm sure the remnants of the Brotherhood will, you know, eventually help in the final war. You do have Thomas Evans' mission to River Run, which will be interesting to see.
Do you think she'll run into Arya at some point?
I think she'll run into one of the children, but I reckon at this point Sansa's just as likely as Arya.
Maybe Nymeria will take her out of her misery.
My thought with this, with reading about Stoneheart and how, like, decayed she was, but there was still, like, a little bit of her left in there. I kind of, like, I wonder, like, what the magic similarity between, like, the Whites and the Catelyn and Beric and presumably John, if he gets resurrected. I don't want to destroy Tanya's hopes and dreams. I wonder if, like, the magic is similar, or if it's, like, if it really is, like, surrounding the Azor Ahai or Lord of Light.
The Whites don't really seem to have any part of their personality left, right? Or their memories or anything. It's just that John notices that the White that comes after the Lord Sombra. Commander, he must have remembered like a little bit, but there's nothing left of the person, right? Whereas in Beric's case, he was reanimated like right after his death. So
we don't know how much is left, right? I don't think we have that much insight into any of the Whites, so I don't really know whether we can say how much of their memories and stuff is left. Probably not as much.
Basically, they don't like talk or anything. They don't say anything. They're just like kind of zombies, basically.
Yeah, but I mean,
whereas in Beric's case, he's almost whole.
Yeah,
like he's missing part. Like every time he comes back, he's missing more and more. But the first time, he's like he's pretty much fine, right?
Mm.
So I don't know. It doesn't seem to be like the same kind of magic. I don't know.
I mean, the same result, maybe, but...
Yeah, different magic. And the blue eyes are kind of like the main feature of the Whites, right? They all have blue eyes.
Yeah, that's...
Mm.
And Catelyn does not, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I think she does Catelyn have
blue eyes anyway.
Yeah, I think she has blue eyes regardless.
I think it's more beneficial to compare their resurrection to the others themselves, where I think they undergo a similar type of, you know, ritual for that, with the whole breathing the fire of life back into them. The Whites are kind of their own
Is this show separate stuff?
Case. No, it's not. It's me. No, it's not. No. Theorizing.
It's theorizing.
I mean, the Whites are a separate case because they're presumably, like, I mean, yeah, they're close to zombies. They're probably controlled in some sort of way by the others. But, in this case, I just think it's, if we're guessing how the others were formed, you know, some sort of ritual where you just have a similar thing just on the other side of the coin. I've always thought that, you know, the magic of the others and the magic of R'hllor is just two sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
Is the others' magic derived from the Children of the Forest?
That is one theory, yes.
Are they a race on their own, or are they a creation?
So the personal theory I ascribe to is that the Children of the Forest created the others. As like an act of desperation or to fend off the Andal invaders.
And then their magics have developed, or did they create them with this power? Like, can the Children of the Forest raise the dead like the others can?
We haven't seen anything.
No, of course you haven't seen anything. This is completely out there. Just wondering.
Doesn't seem, I wouldn't guess that.
I don't know. It's an interesting thing. But then what would you attribute Gregor Clegane to? The magic of science? You know, Robert Strong.
That's more like Frankenstein, isn't it? Like, there's a doctor experimenting on it. I don't know.
Well, we don't know. I mean, is it black magic or is it some sort of, like... I mean, has he got, like...
Yeah, we don't...
He's got, like, an electric machine in the dungeons of the Red Keep.
We don't have enough information.
Hard to guess on that one.
I guess we also don't know how, like, autonomous he is, or, like, how alive are that we see.
His obedience seems to be similar to that of the Whites, where, you know, they will listen to the other that's controlling them. Or I don't know how it works, but they do things without question. Whether it's like a warg situation and the others in the White, I don't know.
Yeah, whereas like Beric and Lady Stoneheart seem to be...
They have independent thought, yeah. So, I don't know, I guess maybe it's just subtle differences in each of the resurrection magics.
Yeah.
Who knows? It's cool to think about. I'm excited to find out more.
Yeah, I really hope that Wins goes into more of the, I'm actually looking forward to there being like more magic-ish type stuff in the next few books, because I feel like that's what we're getting towards. I know that some people don't like want this kind of to remain like a political medieval fantasy story, but I'm actually really looking forward to there being like a more magical concept of the world. Let's move on to the Drowned Man chapter. To preface, we're not going to be talking about any T-WoW chapters or alluding to any T-WoW chapters, which includes even, for now, I'm going to include any of the written ones as well. So like when we get to Arya, don't talk about Mercy until like we've talked about that chapter, the Arya 13 chapter. Noah, you have Aaron 2.
Yes, the Drowned Man. I love this chapter. The chapter opens with a cold, wet, naked Aaron Greyjoy graying in the sea on Old Wick, having not slept, eaten, or drunk fresh water for some time. As he leaves the water and makes his way to Naga's Hill, we get the story of Naga, the first sea dragon. She fed on krakens and could drown a whole island with her waves. Slain by the Grey King, all that remains thousands of years later are 44 petrified ribs the size of trees. Aaron beholds all the banners of those who have gathered for the king's move, and he is comforted by the voice of the drowned god. Or is that just the madness from sleep deprivation and dehydration? He orders his drowned men to sound the summons and wake the captains. As the Ironborn gather, Aaron spies his hulking brother Victarion, thinking surely he will be chosen as king. Aaron begins the king's move by updating all present on Balon's death, and struggles to list his few achievements as king before opening the floor to all claimants. First up is Gilbert Fairwind, a bloke from the Lonely Light, who proposes they pack up and leave the Iron Islands for the uncharted lands of milk and honey to the far west. Convincing few of his words, his treasure is only some seal skins and walrus tusks, which convince even fewer, not even all of his family, cry his name. Second to claim the Seastone chair is 88-year-old Eric Ironmaker, who at 20 stone puts Lord Manderly's belly to shame. His grandsons struggle to carry him on a driftwood chair to the podium. He boasts of past deeds but says little of importance before he's cut down by Asher, who challenges him to stand up and claim the crown. In that, he fails as well. Next up is Dunstan Drum, who has a pretty awesome Valyrian steel sword and some very intimidating supporters with awesome names like Andric the Unsmiling. His speech, while initially good, even bores the seaweed in Aeron's damp hair. And he's a bit of a cheapskate when it comes to his treasure. Aeron and Victarion have a bro moment and lock eyes before Vic finally takes the stage. He keeps it short and sweet and promises to give the Ironborn more of what they had with Balon. A popular man, many call his name and his plunder and take his plunder of gold and jewels. Before Aeron can wonder about Euron's silence, Asha takes to the stage. She cuts down her uncle easily and fights off rampant sexism while making a coherent argument for the future of the Ironborn. She offers victory through peace and splits popular opinion down the middle. The mob are crying Asha and Victarion's name when a horn is sounded by one of Euron's mutes. He ascends the hill and addresses the captains, claiming to be able to offer more than anyone so far, all of Westeros. Euron says the horn blown is one he found in the ruins of Valyria, and that it can bind dragons to his will. Despite protests from Asha about his far-fetched claims, when his chests of gold and jewels are opened, all the captains cry his name. Aeron, defeated, reaches inside himself to find the drowned god for help. But he hears only silence.
I think it's interesting how like democratic this is, even though the Ironborn, for the most part, seem like the least
sophisticated.
It seems like the last place in Westeros where you'd expect something as modern as democracy, I guess. So I thought that was quite interesting.
It's not entirely. About that. Basically what it is, who's the strongest and who can give the most money out seems to be...
So it's really democratic.
it's similar to the Night's Watch choosing, I suppose. It lacks the golden and awesome speeches.
Decent comparison.
Yeah, although like the Night's Watch doesn't have like a necessarily like rules over like anything except for like themselves. So it this seems like, as far as like kingdoms and like people who are actually in charge of Westeros go, like it seems like very democratic. And even Bina pointed it out here. It's very close to caucuses and public debates. And she noted that it's funny because in chapter 57, or maybe reread 57, she argued that there was no democracy in Westeros, but this is probably the only place there is.
Well, I mean, you got to remember this hasn't been done for a very long time.
Yeah,
they haven't called a King's Moot in a long time.
Did they do it before Baelon came to power?
They did it a long time ago. I think once Aegon took over. Yeah, once Aegon the Conqueror came, it became like kind of hereditary. And the Greyjoys have been in power ever since.
Mm-hmm.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, I think it was Vicon Greyjoy. It mentioned in this chapter somewhere.
Yeah, it's Vicon Greyjoy was.
Basically Aegon chose him to be the Lord of the Iron Islands. So there hasn't been a Kingsmoot in centuries because there hasn't been a king, like it hasn't been a kingdom for that long.
I wonder if it's like maybe slightly sexist they're having a Kingsmoot just because, like, technically, like, if we're supposed to go with, like, lineage rules, like, Asha should be queen. And in this case, it seems like Aaron's like, Kingsmoot, Victorian king, we're gonna make that happen. And then it ends up backfiring completely and horribly.
Mm.
Whereas I feel like, I mean, I'm a lady, so I tend to take the side with Asha. And I think like her argument for peace is like probably like the best thing for the Iron Islanders at this point, with like just leaving everybody alone in Westeros, do their own thing, and like they can prosper.
Yeah, her speech is very reasonable. You know, when she brings those pebbles and the pine cones, and it all makes so much sense. But then I was like, this is going to be totally lost in the Iron Islanders.
Yeah,
they don't use that much logic.
Yeah,
you have to know which kind of audience you're campaigning for, and I guess that's the mistake.
Yeah, exactly.
Should have known this wasn't
going
to appeal to them, even though she's right. Yeah, yeah, I'm convinced, but...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was very logical, very, you know... but, yeah, the Iron Islanders are never going to go.
Yeah, that's true. Like, the Iron Islanders are kind of... Their philosophy is very much, like, conquest, conquer, and, like, you know, like, at least try. Like, even though Baelon very much failed and... many instances that he's tried to be king of Westeros, it seems like they're still on board with that, and it seems like if you serve and, you know, serve and die for your Iron Island country, it seems like you're probably, like, it's an honor more than a sadness for people there.
It was Euron actually kind of took her argument and made it the correct way, at least in terms of, you know, reaching the other Ironborn. Like, she needed to just pick a spot, like, on, you know, on the western coast of Westeros, and then just say, okay, we're going to conquer this, and then we're going to, you know, just expand our kingdom there and kind of, like, help us with all of their issues with the fact that they just don't have enough resources to actually have a fully functioning kingdom.
I really liked Gilbert's idea with the going off into the Sunset Sea and finding the new land out there.
Did anyone think that he was talking about Numenor? Where did Grant's idea go? I think we can talk about this with that. It's just Numenor is supposed to be an island off the coast of Middle-earth, of the western coast of Middle-earth. So it just kind of suddenly reminded me.
Oh, that's funny.
that's a good parallel. There's a bit of tinfoil on this guy that I dug up. He was... So the Fairwinds up on Lonely Light, the westernmost point in the known world, I think. And they're alleged skin changers, so wargs, pretty much. And you can only find green seers when you have skin changers. It's like 1 in 1,000 or something. And do you reckon he's seen the future and knows that the world is ending, so we need to go west and
south?
we need to leave, because he mentions Nymeria, and that was a similar sort of we need to leave this land type deal.
I actually thought it was funny that he mentioned Nymeria, since like Nymeria isn't really related to their like past. It's more of a Dornish thing, but yeah, I thought that was funny. But that's like a really interesting way to like think about it.
Maybe he's got a daughter who sees the doom.
And their name is Daenerys Greyjoy.
Fairwind.
Ah, sorry.
Yeah, just a bit of tinfoil. Had to bring some to the table.
Mm-hmm. I love
but,
it.
I did love a line in Ash's speech where she completely cuts down Victarion. She says, he counts to 10 as quick as any man. I've seen him do it. Though when he needs to go to 20, he must take off his boots.
I don't want to like harp too much on Victarion being annoying, but I'm going to say that Victarion's annoying. I'm sorry, Patrick, if you're listening. I actually think that he's an interesting character, but I also think that he's very much like just keeping the same with Baylan. Like his speech is like, I'm going to keep on doing what Baylan was doing. Isn't that awesome? And everybody was like, yeah, kind of.
No, not really. Has been working.
And I don't.
Well, it's split down the middle, isn't it? Asha has quite a lot of support here in the end. I mean, before Euron.
Yeah, it seemed like half of them were for Victarion and half were for Asha. And then Euron came up and they were like, oh, you're completely different. Let's do you.
And he also had the most gold.
And he also had promises dragon of dragons. Horn. Yeah. Yeah, so the dragon horn, like,
yeah,
does he really have the dragon horn? Is it really?
I'm going to be so pissed.
I'm going to go with yes.
I don't think he does.
Yeah, the Valyrian steel.
Yeah, it's huge. And the guy dies afterwards.
That's other chapters, I think, right?
No, it says it's got Valyrian steel wrapped around the horn.
Yeah,
glyphs.
And no, it has like dark steel, right? Which is Valyrian steel is a very dark color, and then it has like Valyrian glyphs and stuff. So it looks authentic, but I don't know.
Right, no, it's got some sort of magic to it. We just don't know what it is.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the guy who's blowing on the horn, he basically, his tattoos start to bleed.
Yeah,
like,
his chest is
what
bleeding.
What kind of horn does that?
I know.
Yeah. And he dies, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, it does seem very promising to be the horn. But I also, like, I wonder if it, like, if that's its actual power.
Like, yeah, it could do something. It could do something else.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's clearly something magic going on, right? But we don't know what.
Yeah.
Exactly. So.
Yeah, it's just I can't stand mind control. Like it just has a plot point. So I really hope it doesn't work.
Yeah.
Oh, there's gonna be so many horns in the next book. Can't wait. I did have a couple little things. So yes. More crackpot if you want some.
I always want crackpot.
there's a girl in the chapter that, while we're talking about parallels with the Night's Watch choosing, there's a girl in the chapter that keeps squawking like throughout the whole thing. And then when Euron gets to the to give his speech, it goes crazy and it's like screaming all over the place. So is this like Blood Raven feebly trying to warn us?
I think we all like that.
That's a sign that, you know, everyone doubts that he's gone as where he has says he's gone. But I mean, where do you get a horn like that, if not in Valyria?
There's this Stannis chapter in which it's mentioned that there's this island close to Dragonstone where there's supposed to be, they have this horn that can summon dragons from the deep, and they have like, I think it's the Valyrian treasure. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
They have like lots of gems.
Yeah, the Valyrian steel axe and all of that stuff.
Okay. There's plenty of, you know, descendants of Valyria lying around, so there can be artifacts lying around anywhere.
Well, a couple Ironborn have. There's two Ironborn there who have Valyrian steel swords.
Yeah.
So I guess it's, you know, but then we don't hear of, like, you know, there's not been a pirate plundering Dragonstone or something like that, you know. So, you know, the only other place to get it was probably Valyria. But anyway, way out there.
Kind of one of the things, I mean, people always talk about kind of Victarion being annoying, kind of. But for me, it's always been, like, Aaron is kind of like the character I've felt was most pointless, at least until recent events. But, like, reading through his...
Sorry, go ahead. No, no, no.
But, like, reading through this chapter, I actually kind of feel bad for him. Like, with all the trauma he went through as a child, like, I mean, what else can he do? Like, he's trying his best.
You get the creaking door throughout the whole chapter.
Yeah, that's the best line. I mean, the best line is the final one, which, you know, as a thousand voices shouted his brother's name, all he could hear was the scream of a rusted iron hinge. Like, that's terrifying.
Yeah, it is.
So I feel like I should give him more of a break. And then also that you kind of get a little bit of the history of the religion, which is just types of things that I like in these types of stories. Where that's another thing that I always, you know, felt was pointless, just because I don't think there's really any magic behind it. But it seems like it actually kind of served a purpose here, where, you know, with the living style of the Ironborn is really, you know, unsustainable because they don't have the resources. So they kind of created a religion that, like, promotes the raiding lifestyle as just kind of like a survival mechanism, because that's, you know, the only way they're going to get enough kind of like food and other things to survive, you know, without, at least, unless they can have favorable trade, but that's also difficult.
I thought, like, the story of Naga was fascinating.
Yeah.
It made me, like, go to some, like, crack pottery theories on that, but I was like, I tried to, like, not focus on too much crackpot this time around.
Yeah.
But why? Is this be okay?
Yeah.
I'm the host. Yeah. I have to be the voice of reason here.
He's why I never host anything. Did you have any crackpot things to report on that?
Well, it made me think, like, what if there's dragons at some point that actually, like, what if that story actually is real? That right. Aaron had.
Mm. A sea dragon. Can it, like, breathe fire too? I don't know.
Breathe salt water.
Breathe salt water.
It's just a giant, like, riot fire, like, water cannon.
or just breathe salt. That'd be terrible. Yeah, salt dehydrates everything.
That could actually be terrible.
I will rust all of your armor.
Well, I mean, like, it could be a powerful thing. Like, it could drown people, so...
Yeah.
Well, it ate, what was it, krakens and leviathans.
Ooh.
Which is pretty impressive to feed on that, so it must have been huge. Mm-hmm.
And it also seems a bit out of place since, like, you know, the Greyjoys, their sigil's a kraken, and, like, they seem to revolve around, like, the krakens more than they do, like, a sea dragon.
Why wouldn't you take the thing as your sigil that eats the kraken? Like,
yeah. That's
like
what...
the more powerful thing.
Exactly. Mm. Unless they all fear it.
But the Kraken is not a symbol of the Ironborn, it's a symbol of the Greyjoys.
Yeah.
Oh, I meant the Greyjoys, I'm sorry. I wonder if anybody has a sea dragon sigil.
I don't know, what's the Valyrian symbol?
Well, the Valyrians are not Ironborn.
Oh, it's just a seahorse. Yeah, but they're like, you know, traveling sea people, and they also have, you know, dragons in their past, so I figure.
Maybe. Yeah.
Seahorse.
But no, it's just a seahorse. The least threatening thing.
That's sweet though.
So I want to go on. Does anybody have anything else on Aaron 2?
Yeah, I wanted to comment on the religion thing that you said earlier, Matt. About this religion that kind of promotes a certain lifestyle. I've also thought about, I mean, I don't know if George looked this up, but apparently CPR has, like, fairly low survival rates, because I know, like, on TV and stuff, everyone survives if they get CPR. Mm. But apparently the survival rates are, like, I heard this the other day somewhere, I don't know where, but, like, on the internet, so it must be true. it's like 15% or something, so it's really low. And I wonder if, it sounds really harsh, but if this is, like, a way of, I mean, I don't know how many people they, like, the Ironborn lose. I don't know if we know.
Oh, population control. Interesting.
Yeah, like, I wonder if that's part of it, if this is a religion that also promotes population
control. I think in a previous Aaron chapter, you hear about, you know, like, priests who've never lost a man or something like that, or Aaron has never lost a man.
Or is that then support for the hypothesis that there might actually be magic involved? Or George just didn't look up unreliable CPR.
I think George subscribes to TV theories that, like, CPR brings back most people. That's what I'm going to go with.
Very well, yeah.
I also think it's mentioned that there are various, like, levels to it, whereas kind of lords just kind of get more of a baptism-style thing, and it's really only, you know, the most, like, crazy religious, like Aaron, that actually, you know, try to go down and go unconscious, right. Whereas I don't think everyone, at least the majority of the people, go through that.
Well, I think everyone goes through it once, but Aeron got, it was in the Greyjoy Rebellion that he got drowned, wasn't it?
I think it's from his first chapter of this, I don't know.
Yeah, in the failed attack on Lannisport, he gets drowned and then becomes a zealot after that, after his imprisonment.
I wonder how much brain damage Aeron has, like, just from drowning himself.
Probably not.
Well,
standing naked in the waves.
No more than the childhood trauma he received. Like, it's not going to be that much.
And drinking all that salt water, that must be unbearable.
I know. I was thinking the same thing when he, like, when he filled up his, water thing. I was like...
Don't do that. That's a terrible idea.
Yeah. I was like, he must be in a freshwater area. And I was like, no, he's actually drinking salt water.
I guess hope he's gotten used to it. I don't know.
His stomach lining has, like,
and then
the barrier.
He washes his clothes in salt water. And he... I mean, there's this description of his clothes, like, crackling because...
Yeah.
Briny.
They're covered in salt, yeah.
So gross.
Yeah.
Maybe Victarion's not the biggest idiot in the family, after all.
Tanya, did you have something?
No, that was...
Oh, sorry.
I just wanted to complain about how everyone dies from CPR in real life.
Come on, George, get on the CPR actual statistics.
Or maybe this means that there's actually some magic involved too, but I guess the general consensus seems
to
be.
So do we
want
to call this George CPR, like George R. Martin genetics?
I'll buy some Drown God magic. I'll buy that.
Could be.
Yeah.
We haven't seen any yet, so if this is it,
yeah, that might be it.
So I want to go on to the next one since we're probably going to talk a lot about the preview chapter later on. But I do want to say that, like, while I was rereading this, I, like, you know, a lot of people hate on Feast. But I actually do think that in comparison, the Dorne, that the Greyjoy story / Ironborn story has a lot more to it than, like, it feels like Dorne's out of place rather than this being out of place to me.
Mm, really? I'm the exact opposite.
Really?
I mean, it's mainly because The Princess in the Tower is actually my favorite chapter of the entire series. Like, I really enjoyed that one. Yeah, so I'm kind of biased in that sense.
Well, I'm biased. This was my favorite chapter in the book.
Yeah, but Dorne fits in more because their entire conspiracy still involves the Iron Throne and control of Westeros and everything, whereas the Iron Islands are not concerned. I mean, they want to conquer stuff, but they're basically very... they're more concerned about themselves than the rest of Westeros.
Yeah, I mean, in my point of view, I feel like Dorne wasn't really involved with the War of Five Kings, and Baelon obviously was. So they needed to, like, you know, wrap up his death in some way to, like, show that the war was over. And I feel like that still, like, even if George did the 3-year gap, that would have been still a big thing with the gap involved. So that's why I kind of feel like that way. But, like, I love the characters of Dorne, like, you know, as a woman, especially, like, having a society that is all ladies ruling or being able to rule anyways. Yeah.
Well, I think also we've, we had Theon as a POV, Greyjoy.
Yeah.
So we had an in there and also seen a bit of Asha. So maybe it was an easier transition, but yeah. I get the point. I get it.
So after Aeryn 2 from A Feast for Crows, we jump back to A Storm of Swords for Arya 13. A long chapter that begins on the same day, the 30th of January 300. But this also stretches to the 6th of February. At this point, Arya is 11 years old, and this is the last Arya chapter in A Storm of Swords. And she's also the character that has the most POV chapters in this book. And also, she's just hearing about Joffrey and this book, and that's 5 weeks later than, after 5 weeks after, Joffrey dies. So, Nadia, you have this chapter, right?
Yep.
All right.
Okay. The Hound and Arya reach the inn at the crossroads and find a woman hanging from a gibbet. Arya remembers staying at the inn with Sansa on their way to King's Landing and tells Sandor that they shouldn't go in as there might be ghosts. But Sandor wants to drink, so they go in. The sudden silence tells Arya that they all know who Sandor is. Arya sees the soldiers at the inn are the Tickler and Bolivar, and that they have a squire with them. The Tickler and Bolivar ignore the newcomers, but the squire mocks Sandor repeatedly. When the innkeep brings the wine, Sandor suggests that the Tickler and Bolivar have no intention of paying for their meal and will tickle the innkeep for his gold afterwards. Everyone else quickly leaves when they hear this. Bolivar tells Sandor that the mountain is no longer at Harrenhal since Cersei summoned him to King's Landing after Joffrey's death. Arya notices that Bolivar is carrying Ned around with him. Bolivar tells them that Sansa and the Imp are suspected of Joffrey's death, but that Sansa has disappeared from King's Landing. There is also news of the Blackfish being under siege at Riverrun, the fighting between the Blackwoods and the Brackens, and of Arya Stark marrying Ramsay Bolton. The Tickler and Bolivar attack the Hound, and Arya is alarmed to see that the Hound is drunk and sloppy, and he gets pretty badly injured. The mountain's men slowly drive him back, so Arya picks up something heavy to throw at them. The squire grabs her arm, and she's at him. Sandor manages to turn the fight around and kills Bolivar. The Tickler backs off, but Arya stabs him in the back. She stabs him again and again until Sandor drags her off. The squire screams for mercy, so Arya grabs Needle and stabs him in the heart. Arya and Sandor ride towards Salt Bands and finally stop for a rest beside the Trident. Arya cleans and bandages Sandor's wounds, and he passes out from pain. Arya recites a list of names, but realizes she has left out the Hound name. She reminds herself that he killed Micah and adds his name back to the list. In the morning, Sandor is very weak, but manages to get back on his horse, only to collapse a few hours later. Arya gets ready to kill him, but he wakes from his fever and asks her for mercy, but she leaves him to die on his own. She reaches Salt Pans in 6 days and sees a ship at the port. She sells a horse to get enough money for passage to Eastwatch, but gets very little money in return. She goes to see the captain of the ship, but he tells her the money is too little and they are not going north, but home to Braavos. Arya remembers the iron coin Jack and Hagar gave her, and she shows the captain and says Valar Morghulis. The captain promises her a cabin. That's it.
All right. Awesome. So
great chapter.
Yes. Lovely chapter.
It feels like a very short chapter for how much is happening.
Nadia, what were you saying?
Arya's chapters are so painful to read. Like, just some of the lines are so... Like, it's hard to remember that she is an 11-year-old child.
Yeah, and all the things that she has to deal with in this chapter. As Bina points out, I'm just going to read her note. Compare Arya at the start of A Storm of Swords to the end. The way she... cases the inn, notes every detail of the weaponry her opponents carry. It's like a mafiosi who chooses to sit at a certain place at the bar. Her ruthlessness, her trauma, she's a well-trained killer even before she gets to her quote-unquote formal training. But she's still also a naive kid, thinking Sansa has a choice in whether to marry the imp. And I love that about George's writing. And I also kind of felt like, you know, Arya's character at the beginning of Storm versus the end, like, she's full-blown, like, murdering, is it the Tickler? Or is it Bolivar?
Tickler.
Continually stabbing at the end of that fight scene between the Hound and them, just brutal. And how the Hound had to pull her off of him.
Is this the first time she gets a chance to kill someone on her list? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think technically with Jack and Hagar.
Oh, right. So, but this is not the first time that she's first-handed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's different.
Yeah.
But the line that really got to me was, you know, when she hears about Joffrey dying, and then she thinks, Joffrey was dead, but if Rob was dead too, what did it matter? And that's just so sad.
Yeah, she gets absolutely no satisfaction from killing them and knowing that they're dead, which I think is a... I feel like it should have been a wake-up call for her that she, like, it doesn't even matter anymore, but it definitely is not.
Yeah, she thinks that, but that doesn't cause her to drop a list or whatever. She still wants people to die, even though she's... Maybe in a way that makes it even worse, because she does think it doesn't really matter anymore and still...
Yeah. Her numbness is pretty striking and you know, worrisome as if you're like, you know, thinking of, if you're thinking along the lines of like Arya is like a socio/psychopath, whatever the proper definition is. Like, those are kind of like behaviors, like not feeling empathy and yet not feeling like good about it either. I worry about like where she's heading to. She's going to end up being more of like a Catelyn Stark / Lady Stoneheart in the end, or if she's gonna end up finding her way back to herself at some point.
You still see like glimpses of the child Arya, like the child that she should be coming through when she thinks about Sansa, and I think when they talk about how Sansa killed Joffrey with a spell or something, how she thinks that's stupid, and she has these like very childlike ways of reasoning about things, and it's really heartbreaking to see that she's retained that. And it's such a stark contrast to where she is in her life and what's going on.
I found it funny in this chapter that, like, she wanted to be, like, near a wolf. Like, she was actually, like, jealous that, like, Sansa turned into a bat and, like, wolf flew away. Or I forget, like, the exact animal that was
she turned into a wolf with bat wings or something.
Yeah, it was a flying wolf.
Which I thought was...
I want to be a flying wolf. I think that's pretty cool.
Which I think is, like, a hilarious, like, you know, word-of-mouth, like, news carrying. Like, she flew away instead of just left. but she thinks of Sansa as, like, not a wolf anymore. She thinks of herself as very wolf-like. And she also thinks of Catelyn as a wolf, which I find odd. Especially since, like, you know, Catelyn should be a fish. technically, but she married in, so I guess she counts. but I thought it was interesting that she, like, felt like everybody except for Sansa was very wolf-esque, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's everyone's perception of Sansa, right? That she's the least Stark-like of all the Stark children.
Yeah. But I'd also say the same about Catelyn, so that's why I wonder why Arya is, like... I don't know why she's thinking of her mom so much as, like, a wolf, or I wonder if, like, because of this, her dream of finding dead Catelyn, making her think of a wolf type thing, like, if maybe dead Catelyn has taken on more of a wolf-like persona.
I do think Catelyn has identified with being a Stark on some level, and I do think that would have left an impression on the children. And then also, I think the way children perceive their own families is a bit different from maybe an outside perspective, because Caitlin has always been around, right? She's always been a Stark for all of Arya's life.
Yeah, that's true.
Mm.
No, it's interesting. I did also, like Bina pointed out, I felt that it was kind of funny that she thought that Sansa would have like a say in marrying the imp. Like, she's like, Sansa would never marry the imp. Why would she let that happen? And like, I feel like by now she should know that, like, she hasn't had like much autonomy in her like decisions with like how to live her life, and neither.
I mean,
why would you think Sansa?
I wonder if this says quite a lot about the difference between two sisters, because Arya wouldn't, right? Like, Arya wouldn't marry anyone. She doesn't want to. She would find a way to get away, right? She'd escape, yeah. Worst case scenario. Like, I don't think you could possibly force her to marry anyone. And Sansa just isn't like it's not really an option for Sansa to
she fights it in a different
way. To run away at that point, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she just doesn't have the same, like, she has different ways of fighting the circumstances she's put in. But I guess Arya can't really relate to that, and she wouldn't. She knows she wouldn't have put up with that, which is maybe a bad way of phrasing this. But I think it just says quite a lot about the different ways they interact with their environment and they would act in the same situations.
Yeah, I agree. We also get news here about fake Arya for, I think, the first time, unless I'm forgetting it being mentioned earlier. I like how she, like, hides her, like, surprise, like, within her drink, being like, oh, okay, they have another Arya that they're pretending it's me. I'm the real Arya. I know that comes more into play in Dance of Dragons, but very... It sets up a lot of mystery for the coming books, I think. George set that up.
Yeah, we actually get a pretty decent, like, kind of info dump here with the Mountain taking back Harrenhal and the Siege of River Run, the Blackwoods and the Brackens fighting, and then Randall Tarly kind of taking Maiden Pool. It really sets everything up for Feast and Dance.
Yeah.
I like these little updates that you get.
Yeah.
It's fun to see where each character is at.
Although, like the news of Sansa flying away, like, you wonder, like, how much of it is accurate, I think, when I read it again. Like, I was like, what's really going on? And, of course, we know with reading Feast and Dance that most of what they say is accurate, except for Sansa turning into a bat.
Well, I mean, a wolf, maybe, but a bat as well? That's just ridiculous.
Flying wolf, though.
Wow.
Obviously real.
Well, no. I mean, Kat's mom was a Went, wasn't she?
Right, that's what I meant. Like, all the Went. I couldn't remember the name. All the Wents are dead at this point.
Oh, that's funny.
Is anyone a little bit surprised how the Polliver and the Tickler challenged the Hound? Isn't he supposed to be a complete badass, even if he is a bit drunk?
He seems very drunk.
Yeah, I think that's kind of like the main point. Yeah, I guess you could say, but it's also, I mean, I think that's part of the realism of the story. You're not going to get the crazy sword duels that you get in other fantasies. It's going to be more brutal. You know, like with Barristan's one, like he wasn't a better swordsman. He just had armor to protect him at that point.
Yeah, very true. That's the one I was thinking of.
Yeah.
I had two thoughts while reading this. My first thought was like that I felt like Sandor's a bit of a lightweight because he like downs a bottle of wine and then he's like wasted within 5 minutes, which I thought was funny. But then also I like on a more serious note, I guess I felt like, you know, there's a lot of like references to alcohol at the end of this with at least reading these both of the epilogue and the Arya chapter. It's like alcoholic. Sandor's probably an alcoholic.
Aaron's a former alcoholic.
Probably doing other stuff. but it's interesting, like, seeing, like, an alcohol problem in Westeros.
I mean, how else are you going to get through that life?
Yeah.
They have beer for breakfast and stuff, don't they?
I mean, it would be quite common, presumably, wouldn't it? Because also, maybe it might be easier to acquire alcohol that's safe to drink than water.
Those are the only two drinks,
so it wouldn't be that uncommon, presumably.
Easily
it wouldn't
accessible.
Be recognized as that much of an issue, so.
yeah there seems to be a running theme of alcoholism and problematic characters throughout, like, I would say the entire book series, especially with King Robert. I think that's our first instance of it.
All right, so, I mean, this chapter is really well written. There's a lot of good stuff in here, starting with, I really like kind of the subtle reference to Needle we get before the fight starts, where Arya just kind of, like, notices it briefly on Polliver. And then we get, I mean, the whole sentence of Arya's breaking point of, is there gold in the village, is fantastic. You remember where the heart is, like, that line is repeated several times. And also the Hound's kind of final speech here, where as he tries to convince Arya to kill him. It's all really good, and with her retort, you know, you shouldn't have hit me with the axe, you should have saved my mother. It's a very quotable chapter, and I really enjoy it. And then in terms of kind of Arya's descent here, I think there are a couple key points where, you know, on the bad side, we get her breakdown, and then we also see later in the Salt Pans where she, you know, killing someone is now kind of an option in her repertoire to kind of deal with situations where she's like, well, I can't kill her, you know, I'm in the wide open. But on the other side of that, leaving the Hound off her list as well as not killing them, I think is a big representation of she still has, you know, some sort of code that she's going by.
Therapist would call it progress.
Yeah, and she still has the ability to, you know, change her mind at this point.
Yeah, I did find it interesting that she questioned herself for getting the Hound at that, like, when she was going off of her list, and she, like, listed off the people that are left now, and then she was like, the Hound, oh my god, I forgot the Hound, why did I do that, why did I forget the Hound, like, this is crazy. I find it reasonable, because, like, they just want to fight together, and she's also, like, half taking care of him.
But then she's, like, she's getting ready to kill him, like, she's about to do it when he wakes up. And when he asks for it, she's like, okay, if you want it, I'm not going to give it to you.
Yeah, no, it's
11-year-old's reaction.
Yeah,
I think she was still debating at that time. I don't know. I kind of interpret it as that she thought about it, but
well,
I don't think she...
Well, yeah, she'd gotten into position, and she was thinking about whether, you know, she should actually do it or not.
Right, yeah, she still hadn't made up her mind then.
Yeah, but him asking for it, I think that did make up her mind. She was like, no.
Yeah,
I'm not going to do it if asked.
Yeah, if he wants it, she wanted it to be her.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Like, the word mercy is repeated so many times. That kind of leads into the other chapters. But yeah, it's something that's you know, repeated multiple times.
So when Jaqen gives her the coin, what do you think this means, like when you give it to a man from Braavos? Does it mean I'm a faceless man, give me what I want? Or what does it kind of signify when she gives this man the coin? What does it tell him?
Presumably from what comes later in Feast, you know, it was kind of a fairy payment, essentially. Like, she gained her entrance, and that was it. It seemed like a first level type thing where, you know, she could get passage to the house and then entrance into the house, and that was it.
But what does that mean? Does it mean that this guy thinks she's a faceless man?
No, I think he thinks that she's an initiate.
Nadia?
But I think if that were true, he wouldn't be so, like...
scared.
When she gives him the coin, he immediately says, oh, of course you'll have a cabin. Like,
yeah.
You know, that's...
yeah.
If she was just, you know, being initiated into the House of Black and White, that wouldn't be true. I think the coins, the iron coins, are something that's very rare and probably are only given to spacemen. And Jaqen basically passed his on to her. And that's probably why, like, you know, it's, I don't know, this is just like a theory, but, you know, maybe it's something that's, you know, given to the faceless man so they can use the resources of Braavos to get around to doing all their assassin work or whatever it is that they do. Right?
Yeah.
So that they don't have to constantly pay over and over again, like, you know, they want to get from this place to this and then they have to pay and then they go to another place and then they have to pay again. It's just like they have this one coin that they can use to, you know.
But then he doesn't, like, the captain keeps the coin, right?
I don't think so, because doesn't she still have it on her when she enters the house?
All right, so would we like to move on to talking a little bit about Mercy? Or does anybody have anything else before we do that?
Nope.
I'm going to say that as a no. All right, so now we're going to be going into talking about one of the spoiler chapters of Winds. This one was written, or they're all written by George, but this one was actually posted on his blog a few years back. It's titled Mercy, and as Nadia alluded to earlier, like, Mercy is mentioned a lot in Aria 13, and I find that completely fascinating, because, like, I know I've talked a lot about, like, the three-year gap and stuff, but, like, presumably that would be, like, the first chapter we would have gotten after, like, if we didn't have Feast or Dance, so I find that it actually, like, parallels to it quite perfectly, and kind of makes it more mysterious if we didn't have Feast and Winds. Not that they're not good books. I'm just... I just find it that it parallels quite nicely.
Definitely.
Who was the guy who she murders in Mercy? It was someone from the list, right?
Dunstan?
No, it's Raph.
No, Raph the Sweetling?
It's Raph the Sweetling.
Yeah.
I feel like the difference between, like, her MO, if you will, from this chapter is very starkly different from Mercy chapter, whereas, like, you know, she's very, like, methodical in this chapter, but then she kind of just loses it when she is attacking the Tickler. And in the Mercy chapter, if I remember correctly, it's very, like, slow killing, not very anguished. And kind of disturbing, since, like, she's pretending to be, if I remember correctly, she's pretending to be a whore and, like, using more of her sexuality.
Yeah, she takes him. Yeah, exactly. She takes him away pretending that, you know, he's going to get some action. And then, you know, he gets there.
And Arya's so
Which is so gross, because she's, like, 10, I don't know.
She's 11 in Arya 13, so I'm assuming she's 12 by the time Mercy happens.
No, I think she
doesn't make it any better.
She should be married with kids.
She's 13, but... I think she's taken on the face of an older girl. That's
so yeah, I mean, I pulled this.
Does not
this
make it okay,
here.
But.
But yeah, she's playing an actress at this point, because she's in a play, which seems to take characters from Westeros. In fact, she might be playing her own sister in this play, like, just a random thing. It just says a young sweet maiden.
Yeah, that's right.
Who's going to be raped and murdered by the dwarf, i.e. Tyrion.
I didn't make that connection.
Yeah, that's right.
So yeah, she's kind of the interesting parallel. And then we kind of get there's the murder in there, and then kind of the other big part is that whoever the envoy was that Cersei sent, like, to the
Iron Bank. Paris Swift, was it?
There you go. So, yeah, he's in town. And that's kind of, I mean, that's going to be kind of probably a big point in Arya's chapters, at least the first few in Winds, kind of see how that plays out.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, with his guards dying, it'll probably be taken as a...
right, yeah.
A bit of a, you know, it's not going to do well for negotiations.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess it kind of shows how far she's come as a as an assassin.
Right, yeah, this is more of her training, learning to be someone else.
Yeah. The chapter felt very, like, unlike her, and, like she's kind of fully lost. Not fully, but, like, more of her is gone.
Isn't that how the faceless men operate? Like, you have to basically leave the person that you were behind before you can start to be one of their sets, right?
Which way do you think it's going to go with her and the faceless men? Do you think she's going to be involved with the whole thing at the Citadel with Jaqen being there? Or is she going to break away from them and go back to Westeros? I mean, as in she'll stay on, you know, get involved with things on the SOC side with Daenerys, perhaps, whatever they're planning for her.
Is it confirmed that Jaqen's at the at the Citadel?
The facial descriptions match.
Okay.
Yeah.
When and he's a faceless man.
Jaqen takes,
he's right,
yeah, he takes on the face of the takes on the face of Bait the big boy after she kills him.
Yeah, but before he does, he has Jaqen's face.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, it's hard to tell just because, I mean, with the timeline going, there's no way that she can complete all of her proper training to become a full faceless man, and then get back to Westeros in time. So I don't know how he's gonna make that work timeline wise. But she's still gonna kind of have that conflict of losing her personality and, you know, fighting against being Arya or not. I mean, I think that's just gonna be the main kind of climactic moment for her character. Where, you know, she'll go through that conflict and, you know, probably obviously choose Arya and then go off on some final mission and she'll die or she won't.
Honestly, I don't know if she'll go back to Arya or not. Like, I want her to.
But she has to go back and die in the snow with needle in her hair. So.
I mean, she won't go back the same way. Like, she'll never go back to being the child she was, right? But I think she'll go back on some level.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe not dissimilar from Kat, where she may just go
right,
back
yeah,
and
guess...
take her own personal revenge on people rather than just doing her faceless man, whatever stuff. But...
Yeah, I guess the main point is, yeah, she's choosing between kind of loyalties, I suppose, not necessarily a personality.
Yeah, no, I don't think
thing.
She'll go back to being Arya, but I think she'll go back to her old loyalties.
So you think she'll go back to Westeros then?
Oh, most definitely.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think so too. I think Braavos is actually like geographically, I think that like it's too far away for her to like catch up with Dany. I think that like she's closer to Westeros. She's more likely to go to Westeros.
Yeah, she's closer there than she is to Volantis. So.
Yeah.
Of course, but I guess in this chapter you don't really even get a hint that she's upset with her lot at the moment with the faceless man. So maybe something quite drastic would have to happen in order for her to feel like she could break away and go home.
I mean, she doesn't really have to have an issue with them, right? It's not necessarily about wanting to break away from them. It's just about preferring her old family loyalty. Maybe she'll struggle with that decision. Maybe she'll also feel loyal to the faceless man and will also want to stay. But one thing will just outweigh the other.
Well, once she hears that John's dead, there'll be nothing left for her there.
Depends on... I hope he doesn't. But it depends on whether he comes back and how he comes back, right? If he comes back, that could be the kind of thing that could potentially like turn her around and convince her that there still is something left. Or we don't know what's going to happen to Bran. I guess Bran is going to be a tree for the rest of his life. We don't know if there's a way of reconnecting with Rickon in some way. Like, she could... Like, at the moment, it seems like there's nothing left. But if John comes back, depending on how he comes back, if Rickon reappears, depending on how he reappears... If Bran starts interfering, maybe Bran can, like, blood-raven her into coming back.
My kind of thought is that, like, her getting back to Westeros might be, like, a thing of, like, the House of, like, the people there. They'll be like, there's a job for you over at, like, the Fingers or, like, something. And...
Yeah.
then she gets closer to Sansa somehow and learns about her that way. Or, like, she goes to somewhere in the north and she hears about Jon or Winterfell or something of the sort.
Does she still have Needle when in the Mercy chapter? Like, is that what she uses to kill Raff?
No, I don't know.
She hid it somewhere, right?
She hid it.
It's still hidden.
Yeah, yeah, I remember that she hid it initially.
I don't think she's retrieved it as far as we know.
No, she doesn't carry it on her.
Okay. No, because she needs to convince them that, like, she's not Arya anymore. She's no
I'm pretty sure she'll go and get it at some point.
Certainly.
Exactly. That's why I was wondering, because that's like her link back to her family, right? That's like the material link back to her family.
Particularly to Jon, but yeah.
Correct. Okay. Right, yeah, I think her kind of the two confrontations she's going to have to help bring her back, or it's going to be either Jon or Nymeria.
Crackpot theory, Arya brings back Jon with Needle.
maybe Needle is Nightbringer.
Was that make Micken?
Yeah.
Jesus.
So, thank you guys for joining me. For those that are following along at home, the next episode of The Reread will be hosted by Bina, and the chapters are the prologue of A Feast of Crows, Brienne 1 from A Feast of Crows, and Tyrion 11 from A Storm of Swords. You can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, iTunes, or the WordPress by searching for Vassals of Kingsgrave. You can also get involved more and go on the forums if you want to talk to us more, and if you want to if you have like a burning comment about something that we got wrong, please post it on the forums. You can Google the A Podcast of Ice and Fire forums and get on join on there. All right, so bye everybody.
Bye.
All right, so we got everybody here. So let's talk about The Forsaken. So from this point on, we're going to be talking about the spoiler chapter that George R. R. Martin read at, I forget what con it was. It was the one in, it was Balticon.
Balticon, yeah.
Yeah, 2016. And he read this Aaron chapter, and we're going off of a transcript of that chapter for information about that. That is online if you want to find that. This chapter, like made me, now that I'm reading the Drowned God chapter, or the Drowned Man chapter, now after reading The Forsaken, like, I feel a bit more sympathetic to Aeron.
Yeah, it's a bit of that Merritt Frey complex, isn't it? He was an arsehole when he was younger, and then you find out the horrible shit that happened to him.
Right.
I feel someone told me a while ago to, after reading The Forsaken, to read the Ironborn chapters again, especially the Aeron ones, and it gives you a whole different perspective on Euron. And you know, it's he's fucking terrifying, Jesus.
It makes me wonder, like, you know, like, when I read this for the first time, I think I, like, kind of, like, saw the horror, and I was like, well, that's cool, but there's probably nothing going to come of it. But now it's kind of like, but now it's like, wow, how important is that, and what's going to happen? Also, why are his lips blue?
shade of the evening, man. Shade of the evening.
Crazy stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, like, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think the Forsaken chapter, I mean, George is a fantastic writer, but I think that was the first chapter that I was actually scared afterwards. It was genuinely a terrifying read or listen, whichever way you consume the transcript.
Yeah. There are a couple lucky few. If you go back to, we ended up doing like a full episode on this on VOK. I forget which number it is. If anybody wants to look that up really quickly. we did a full VOK on this chapter alone. And I think a couple people were actually, like, there in the audience for it, which is awesome. Very jealous.
Yeah, Zach was there. Alias was there, I think. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, him and, oh, God, what's his name? Matt Eiffel. Eiffel in the forums. He was also there.
Yeah.
Mm. Very jealous of them being able to experience that. And from what what I remember them telling me, like, it was very horror-esque. And then I also think that we kind of forget that George, like, his first, like, kind of, not his first, but, like, a lot of his writing is also, like, within horror and within, it's more sci-fi, but definitely horror aspects to it.
Oh, yeah, this is, This one definitely falls in that category. It was VOK 297.
Okay, so if you want to go back and listen to that for more info, then we're probably giving, go do that. But yeah.
So okay. I think Nadia, you were talking about the horn maybe being a kraken horn and not a dragon horn earlier, and you stopped yourself for spoiler reasons. But do you reckon that was do you reckon that's the use of it in the upcoming fight with the Red Wine Fleet?
But no, I think this one might be a dragon horn because it has like all the Valyrian on it and possibly the Valyrian steel. So this might actually be a dragon horn. I was just saying that there may also be a kraken horn out there. So
yeah,
you never know. Maybe they're the same thing. Maybe yeah. They're the same thing. I don't know.
Big monsters it summons. The closest big monster.
Yeah.
Whatever's in range.
But yeah, after reading The Forsaken, I was wondering, is there anything that is, like, important for Euron other than power? Like, you know, he doesn't care about the money. He's, like, taking lands and he's just giving them away. He's got all this, he's amassed this huge fortune and he's literally just, you know, throwing it away at people. Like, what did he throw away into the sea?
A dragon egg, allegedly.
A dragon egg. A dragon egg, which is, like, priceless. He literally just threw it into the sea.
Well, I'm pretty sure he doesn't care about his brothers.
He hates his brothers. He's, like, possibly, you know, molested his brothers, most likely. He has a son or multiple children, I don't know. But he doesn't seem to care about them either. Is there anything that he does care about? Like, for me, that's why he's so scary, because there is nothing that seems to be, you know, that would be safe from him.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Right, he's kind of as close to the Joker as we're going to get in this story.
I feel I feel like that there, like, you know, George has said in an interview something about how when he killed off Joffrey, it was very you can kill off a really awful character, but then you got to create somebody just or worse than this character afterwards. There still has to be some kind of villainesque character, and I think that we all thought that would have been Ramsay. But I'm starting to think now that that character is Euron.
Yeah, he's the, do they call it, the third act villain.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, no, Ramsay's too kind of...
too in the background.
He's too contained into one area of the story, whereas Euron's going for, like, the full, like, final through line.
Shebang.
I feel like even Joffrey was not, like, he was a terrible person, but overall, in terms of, like, Westeros as a whole, it wasn't so bad because he was a minor. He had a regent. He had Tywin basically ruling.
Well, both Tyrion and
right?
Tywin, yeah.
So things weren't that bad, right? Because at least somebody else was in control. But in the case of Euron, he's the one in control. So it's going to be... And he's planning to conquer all of Westeros, so it's going to be pretty bad.
Yeah. One, the thought of him with a dragon as well is not, yeah
that would
not be safe.
That would truly be bad.
I just had, like, when you said the thing about the egg throwing the egg into the sea, with our conversation earlier about Naga, I kind of had a crackpot thought.
Yes.
Turn it into...
Oh, he wants a sea dragon?
Turn it into... That's what he was blowing the horn for. He just cracked the egg, and now it's a sea dragon growing in the ocean, and eventually it's going to kill everybody.
That's amazing.
Book's over. We're done.
if we kind of just want to summarize kind of the main points here, I mean, so, like, the current situation is he's, you know, about to attack Old Town, or at least, you know, outside of it, where he's facing the High Towers and the Red Wines.
Yeah, he's engaging with their fleet. That was how it was left.
Yeah. And then we get kind of, like, an update of what happened to that random boat of warlocks over in Essos, as Pyat Pree shows up for a second.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is then the dreams and how that plays into the others and whatnot.
And then strapping all of the priests to the prows of the ships.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Very, very wonderful part of the chapter. But I think I want to note on to, like, Euron relating to, like, you know, he seems very against Euron. And I feel like when we're reading Feast, like, for the first time, it's kind of just like, okay, what's wrong with Euron other than him being, like, another awful guy in the books that doesn't seem to care about women or basically anything? He just wants power. But then, like, with this chapter, we kind of see, like, how bad he really is, and not just, like, just power-seeking and, going to ruin everything, get dragons and conquer it all, but also, like, in how he treats his own brothers, and kind of validating the creaking door theory that people, not necessarily, like, validating completely, but, like, it's more likely that that is a true theory.
Yeah, it's pretty, I would say it's pretty certain after reading that chapter.
Yeah, it's pretty much guaranteed.
Because it was him and, it was Euron and the other brother, I forget the name of.
Was it Yuri?
Yeah. And he,
we're gone.
They both would, like, lie in bed hoping it wasn't them.
Yeah.
I think something along those lines. So he probably did it to both his brothers.
Oh, yeah.
And I want to note on something that Bina had here to make sure I get in most of her notes. But she said, at this point, I thought Euron as evil in a personal realm, the creaking door theory. And yet after the TWOW previews, one realizes that he is a nihilistic evil in a global public context. Is this the most poisonous sibling relationship of A Song of Ice and Fire? Even more so than Cersei, Jaime, Sandor, Gregor? And I would say, like, as far as violence goes, hell yes. It's very bad.
Yeah. Even with the Mountain and Gregor and Sandor, it was a physical assault, right? He did burn Sandor's face, that was about it, right? It was physical violence. But in this case, it's like, it would be different. Like, sexually assaulting somebody, that's
it. Yeah, and multiple times, too, versus
This is, like,
one head in the fire.
Yeah.
I don't want to, like, you know, I don't want to, like, level up abuse, but it feels like Euron was, like, not only, like, physically evil to them, he was also, like, psychologically messing with them as well. Like, there was so many elements to what he was doing to them.
Yeah.
Because Sandor, it seemed like he would just physically, like destroy him. Or Gregor would physically destroy Sandor.
But then both of them show trauma even like, sort of, even many, many years afterwards. Like, both Euron and Sandor both show, like, the trauma they have on that experience.
Yeah. In different ways, but yeah.
Yeah. But in Aaron's case, it seems to be even worse. Like,
Yeah.
What was it? There's the line about, but I mean, he gets the physical abuse too. I mean, the line about, like, he'd been cut loads of times, so the salt water burns him or something, so he can't sleep. And then his feet have swollen up to the size of hams.
Yeah.
It's like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah. The torture is insane.
Well, you shouldn't, obviously we shouldn't be comparing, but it does kind of eclipse what Ramsay did to Theon in a bit.
Yeah.
And they weren't brothers. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, we find out he's, like, a kinslayer, like, five times over. Like, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And, well, I mean, like, what he does with the girl who's pregnant with his child. Like, he doesn't care about anything.
No. I mean, it's just he wants to become a god.
Yeah.
Yeah, that seems to be his overarching goal.
Yeah.
You know, like, honestly, like, when I first read this, I was kind of like, is this really Euron? Like, is this, like, maybe, like, somebody else? Like, you know, I was kind of thinking, not, like, along the Dario lines, but, like, you know, like, is this person really who he is? He seems like he's more magical. Like, he seems like he's not normal, even. Like, it seems like him, but not, it could be somebody else. But now, like, it seems like he was born this disgusting and terrible somehow. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, for me, it really, like, the whole theory of how he's got something to do with Bloodraven, maybe, like, Bloodraven was interested in him like he was interested in Bran when he was a kid, kind of adds a lot of credence to that. If you think about it, if maybe Bloodraven showed him this other side of the world, as in, you know, the magical side, and then figured out how much of a fucked up bastard he is, even at that age, and then decided to take it away, and now he's kind of been chasing that ever since.
That would be so fascinating if that's, like, actually, like, a real thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that. That's a good theory.
Yeah, it's it really grabbed me when I read that. So many theories came out of this. The blood red sea. You know, do you reckon he's going to summon a kraken to destroy the fleet or something?
Well, he threw out that egg, so I think that's it.
yeah, sea dragon
of course,
is coming.
The sea dragon. I always thought the dragon's egg was for the faceless man.
Oh yeah.
That killed Bane.
Oh, it was payment. That'd be interesting.
Yeah, but again, obviously, nothing's confirmed.
Yeah.
We just need wings.
Right, yeah. Really need that.
The other books.
But like wins especially.
And I was looking at the timeline and like the linear timeline that we based this reread off of, and like I can't, they don't have this in there yet, so I wonder like where this like ends up taking place. Or at least like I from what I think. I don't think that it's
I mean it's I guess yeah, it's probably happening like concurrently with Cersei's, like the end of Cersei's storyline.
No, it actually is in here. It's just up further than I thought. This takes place like, what is this? July 11th, and Jon dies, or, you know, quote unquote, probably dies, a month and a half later.
Oh, wow.
The timelines of this is really fucked. I don't know, like, I mean, I feel it now with, like, you know, going back and forth between Storm, Feast, and Dance. Like, I think the last reread I was on, we read the Arya chapter, or, sorry, the Dany chapter in Dance. it just seems very out of
line. Well, where's this chapter in relationship to the epilogue of Dance?
So, this is on the same day that Barristan's chapter in A Dance with Dragons happens, The Discarded Knight. And then after that, Quentin's chapter.
Right, where he dies.
Yeah.
I guess they got to give in, you know, it's got to permit Victarion sailing all the way over.
Yeah. I mean, this happens during the Arianne spoiler chapter that both Arianne 1 and 2.
All right, yeah, that makes sense.
So this is all kind of happening very, like, concurrently.
Yeah.
It makes my brain hurt a little bit.
Yeah. I think this chapter for me really emphasized how important the Ironborn are going to be. So that's why I said, you know, if you go back and read it again, you're like, right, they're actually a serious major force.
And I think that was evident with Theon's chapter in Back in Clash. But like, I feel like now seeing this chapter like only just emphasizes it more.
Yeah.
Okay, I found it. So yeah, so it takes place like 2 weeks after Kevin dies. So that's why, you know, King's Landing hasn't heard about it yet and whatnot.
Mm.
Yeah. All right, does anybody else have anything more?
Yeah, I want to do one more thing, which is Night King stuff. Just because that's one of my...
Is it show stuff? It's not show stuff, right?
No, okay. No, not at all. No, it's the legend that we get back in Storm. It's just random crackpot theories of mine. I'm not the only one. But I'm just, because it's one of the things, it deals with how the wall comes down, where, like, personally, I'm convinced that in order to, like, for the others to get past the wall, they gotta do, you know, some magic ritual, whatever, whether or not they actually, like, knock it down, you know, either way, they'll break the magic. And so I'm convinced that they kind of, like, need basically, like, a human traitor, essentially, to help them, like, break it. And that's kind of where, like, the story of the Night King comes from, you know, originally. And I was always convinced up to this point that, like, Stannis at this point was the most likely candidate. But he'll, you know, he'll do it on accident, where he'll get so desperate in his kind of, like, fight that he'll, you know, try to call to a power that he doesn't fully understand. And it kind of, like, helps bring them through. But with this chapter, you kind of see, like, Euron seems to be actively trying to, you know, maybe work with the others so he could...
Or at least,
you know,
start a war.
Right, yeah. So he could be that, you know, person that kind of, like, helps bring them south. And you also get you get the image of the women, like, the shadowy women in one of Aaron's dreams that kind of harkens back to the Night King theory and his, you know, corpse bride and whatnot.
Yeah.
That's it. All
right.
I always thought Sam was going to bring the wall down with his trusty horn.
Well, that's one of those things I don't like, where it'd be really convenient for that horn to travel that far south just to, like, land in Euron's hands.
Yeah. Exactly.
I almost wonder if, like, they have the wrong horns. Like, I wonder if, like, Aaron actually has, like, the Wallbringer Downer horn and...
That would be funny.
Why is this not working? And then, meanwhile, at the wall, everything's... Right. Shit's
what
flying
the hell
off
is
the
happening?
Wall. It's like, why is this fucking thing not working? And then 3 months later, they get word that the wall came down.
Oh, man.
Oh, that'd be funny.
Well.
All right, I think we have more than enough things to put in this very long podcast.
Yeah, I'm falling asleep, so I'm gonna go now.
Bye, Nadia.
Bye.
See you.
See ya.
Bye.